computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we're speaking to Chad Nagel. Hello Mr. Nagel, glad to hear
Hello, Len.
I'm glad you made time to talk to me today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Right. We spoke before. It was about a year or a year and a half ago or something. And at that time, we spoke about a number of things. One of the items that was in the show notes was that Judge Napolitano talking to Trump and saying, you know, are they going to release the files? And he's saying, with what I've seen, they can never release them.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. In fact, a lot's happened really since you and I last spoke on your show. I mean, for one thing, I've become a pretty regular contributor to the JFK Facts Substack publication, which is run by Jefferson Morley, probably published upwards of about 50 articles on that site over that time. And we did talk about Judge Napolitano and his conversation with Trump, which is I still obsess over. And it seems now that it's sort of come full circle with the RFK Jr. campaign, which is sort of, he hadn't declared his candidacy at the time that we spoke. And he suspended his campaign in late August. So the whole sort of campaign has been contained in that period since we last spoke. But I'll just give you a rundown of kind of what I've been doing before we talk about that. So JFK Facts is a sort of paywalled site, although it's the cheapest that Substack can be. It's like, you know, $5 a month with the tax, I think it's $6. And, you know, it's a news site, and we've broken some stories, which, of course, I, in my excitement, thought would, you know, really be earth-shaking. But, of course, mainstream media, they didn't really pay a huge amount of attention. But at the time we last spoke, I was also starting to work on a research assistant basis for the Mary Farrell Foundation, of which Jeff Morley is a vice president, and, as you know, is involved in federal litigation at the moment against the Biden administration, and so it's Biden and the National Archives, and I've kind of become a legal affairs sort of correspondent for the site as well, which is sort of explaining the main issues in the case to readers in a way that I think is accessible and not too boring. Of course, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. declared his candidacy, and just very recently decided to endorse Donald Trump. And that prompted me to write the piece that is on Kennedy's and King about, you know, my experience and my reaction to that. I should add that I also was writing articles fairly often for a magazine called The American Conservative. And I wrote one back in May of last year called The Courage of RFK Jr., in which I sort of explained why, you know, I thought he was a vital force in the kind of political realignment that's going on in the U.S. right now, where, you know, liberal and conservative are kind of getting turned on their heads. And in fact, that same magazine, which published about half a dozen articles of mine on the JFK assassination and progress in achieving transparency in that. But today they published Trump is the liberal candidate, and they published that in a flattering way. So the magazine's called conservative, but it's saying basically he is more a promoter of free speech. I mean, that's really what the article's about. I mean, the Democrats are now pretty much on record, their candidate, saying that she thinks certain speech needs to be censored. I mean, just removed. And of course, you know, she's supposed to be an attorney, but the reality is that the only restrictions that we're supposed to have on the First Amendment are, you know, to use the old expression, a yelling fire in a crowded theater, not something somebody puts on a in a social media or chat thread or something, and then that's not supposed to incite people to violence. You know, some fake account, maybe it's not even a real name, maybe doesn't have very many followers, and we've seen kind of a clampdown in the UK, people getting arrested for things they posted on, you know, Facebook and so forth. And unfortunately there, you know, pleading guilty, I mean, I guess the system is they can scare you enough if you can't afford a legal representation and then throw you in jail for several months. So anyway, so it's basically about that. And as you know, RFK Jr. is a big anti-censorship guy. He's run on a platform of public health, how it needs to be. It basically needs to be fixed. We have a kind of toxicity. It's not just political, but actually physical now. You know, we've long had direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising on TV, which means, you know, things that you need a prescription for, they're actually marketing them direct to consumers. And we're the only country in the world, I'm told, except for New Zealand, that does that.
Yeah, I'm always astonished when the on the ad it says, ask your doctor about this, right? You know?
Yeah.
You
know, I mean, like,
hey, doctor, I saw this in Good Housekeeping. It's an ad. What do you think? Maybe I should be taking this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine? And of course, what happens is if they think it's cool, they'll go and ask their doctor, and then the doctor will say, let's see, which company gives me the financial incentive? And then if it's a different one, then they'll say, well, I have something else to recommend that does the same thing. And they won't tell them that this one's made by this company as opposed to this company. In fact, actually, I met some Canadians not long ago who were here visiting. And I was complaining about the pharma ads on TV here because they all have the same structure, these pharma ads. They're a minute long. And the first 30 seconds is, you know, this wonderful voice telling you about all the miracles that this drug can do for you and relieving pain or whatever it is. And the images are people, you know, running through flowery fields or along the beach or hugging each other or their pets or whatever. You know, it's just, it's this utopian sort of vision. And then the second 30 seconds, the second half, is this fast-spoken legal disclaimer telling you, you know, all the possible harms. But the images stay the same. So you have this nightmare voice telling you all the injuries that you could suffer potentially from taking this, but they're still showing the same bucolic images of people in sort of ecstatic situations and so forth with you know, a miasma of colors. And so I think this is a sickening thing. These Canadians I met said, well, we have them now too. And I said, well, I didn't know that, but I hope you don't have them every single commercial break, because that's what we have. You know, I mean, it's you'd watch. It's kind of a lopsidedly large share of ad revenue for everything. And that's controlling now editorial lines and media messages. So we have those things. And then, of course, the third big issue that RFK Jr. leads with is what he calls the forever wars, which are really, I think, just an extension of the corruption that he's talking about. So this corrupt merger of state and corporate power, that's the phrase that he's used from the beginning, is the key word, of course, is corrupt, because we've kind of always had a merger of state and corporate power. It's kind of built into our DNA as a country. but it's become corrupted to the extent that he says, well, for example, take the war in Ukraine. That is de facto a money laundering exercise, because even U.S. officials are saying, well, you know, actually all the money's coming back here. So it's not, you know, is that supposed to reassure us? I mean, that is a really, really cynical state of affairs. So he's kind of trying to punch through the kind of established orthodox narratives. And at the time that he declared his candidacy, I mean, I knew that I would be supporting him, because I'd actually really become acquainted with him during the pandemic in 2020, when he was complaining about, you know, the public health policies, repressive pandemic policies, and how these were all related to a corrupt public health system that was dominated by pharmaceutical companies, which trade in their bottom line, their year-end profits, and not really in public health. But what got me, as somebody who is keen on researching the JFK assassination, was that he was the only audible member of the Kennedy family, and certainly the only candidate, frankly, with any visibility, to have openly rejected the official history, the official narrative that we've been fed all these decades. And he, you know, the Oliver Stone documentaries that came out in 2021, they put him front and center, you know. And so I didn't know that he was planning on running for president, but when he did, I was like, well, that's it. I mean, you know, whatever happens, we should really get behind him. So then I started to volunteer for the campaign. I actually started last year. I was doing some canvassing. And then, you know, I'm by no means a campaign insider, but I became part of a core group in this kind of tri-state area that we live in, sort of Northern Virginia, D.C., and sort of suburban Maryland. And so there was a lot of tabling. There was ballot access drives, you know, where we were going out and asking people to sign forms, and we collected a lot of signatures, and it was a fun experience. I mean, I have to say that I enjoyed meeting everybody. And you know, that now they'll be permanent friends. We meet up, and they haven't stopped their advocacy, and everybody's basically supportive of Bobby's ultimate decision to suspend, to back out and back Trump. And I think what's interesting to me is that I don't know of any, I mean, there may be some, even among the people that I've met, who have said, no, that's it. I'm not going to support Trump. You know, he's too distasteful. But you have to, I mean, I think the parallels are there historically. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, when his father was assassinated in 68, a lot of his supporters, you know, the people that presumably lined the train line that was carrying his coffin all that distance, they voted for George Wallace. I mean, that has to have been a protest vote. There's simply no compatibility. And also, Bernie Sanders in 2016, he was asked by a reporter after Trump won that election, what do you think about the reports that many of your followers voted for Trump? And he said, well, wrong question. I mean, you know, what you should be asking as media representatives is, what would make ordinary people so angry that they would shift their vote from me, who has been, you know, scathingly critical of Trump, to Donald Trump? They must be pretty angry about something. And I think the RFK Jr. campaign is, you know, it's never been particularly, you know, it's not a demagogic campaign at all. And it's kind of, I always used to say, and I still kind of say, that he's sort of too sophisticated for American politics, RFK Jr. I mean, he's written books, he's thought really deeply about a lot of things, and he articulates things, he's able to speak at length. It's not sloganeering as much as Bernie Sanders was. But he did, and so he didn't raise the kind of money, and I don't know how much support he was getting. I mean, his, you know, if you can believe the polls, they were fluctuating a lot, and they had diminished from double figures down to single figures, like mid single figures. But he got over 1 million signatures nationwide, and he mobilized something like 100,000 volunteers. So he easily got enough to get on all the states, and he did it the hard way. And the DNC, you know, did everything they could to block him. First, they blocked him in the primaries when he declared as a Democrat. Then they, once he went independent, realizing, look, I can't compete in any of the primaries. I cannot get on the debate stage. I'm just shut out by Biden. You know, and people had somehow forgotten that Biden was, you know, basically incapacitated. And everyone was shut out in favor of this debilitated man who could not perform in a debate. And it's as if it's all forgotten. It's like 1968 with Hubert Humphrey being installed as the Democratic candidate without winning a single primary because Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated. The only person left was the anti-war Eugene McCarthy. LBJ dropped out. And there's still this myth, you know, that RFK Sr. only decided to run because LBJ dropped out. And that can't be true because RFK declared his candidacy before. It was like two weeks or 3 weeks, I think, before LBJ said, I'm not running. So, you know, the DNC is facing a real crisis at this point. I don't see them as being as offering really any hope. And being as I was the sort of the JFK assassination guy among the volunteers, most of these people, I might add, prioritize, you know, the public health aspects, things like regenerative farming, you know, cleaning up the environment. It's very, you know, farmers market type of people, very nice. But, you know, if they wanted to know about the JFK assassination, you know, I was the guy. And this was a key issue for me. It was at least tied for first place in supporting Bobby. I was like, wow, here's somebody. And he's even from the Kennedy family, which has mostly been fairly sheepish about the assassinations. It's like, no, I have to put it behind us. You know, not think about it. And here's somebody saying, no, not only is the official version of my uncle's assassination not credible, and in fact, an insult to the public's intelligence, but my father's assassination as well is very suspect. And so, you know, at the end, when it culminated with Bobby Kennedy being on stage with Trump in Arizona on the, I think it was the day after the Democratic convention finished and sort of coronated Kamala Harris. You know, I mean, it was timed, I think, to sort of flatten the little poll bump that Kamala Harris got. But I have to admit, I got a thrill. I mean, I did. I was watching this live and seeing Bobby Kennedy on the stage being introduced very graciously, I might add, by Trump, who said, introduced him as having lost his father and uncle in service to our country, and then vowing to establish what he said was an independent presidential commission to sort of revisit the JFK assassination and release all the withheld records. You know, and cynics will say, oh, come on, Trump's never going to honor any of these agreements. He's totally dishonorable and stuff. But what, you know, what else do we have? I mean, it's easy to be cynical. But unless you think that it's not a very important issue, and I happen to think, you know, that it is, as old as it is, I still think that RFK Jr. has made it a live issue in the campaign. It might not be the most frequently heard one, and the debate moderators might not bring it up, but it doesn't make it, in my opinion, less important for that. It's not as urgent as the price of gas or the price of groceries, which are now prohibitive. I mean, people are unhappy. But it's still really important that we somehow revisit it. And there, you know, was RFK Jr. standing on the stage with Trump being introduced this way. And then when he stepped up, of course, he didn't mention it, but Trump had already done it. And I thought, you know, this is something, this is historic. This is a historic moment. And we all ought to be really, really cheering it on. So, and as I say, I mean, as far as the Democrats are concerned, there doesn't appear to be any hope, at least coming from the sort of Biden-Harris, you know, cabal. So we know that Trump disappointed everybody in 2017. He certainly disappointed me by sort of postponing the disclosure for 4 years because he thought he was going to get reelected, right? And then it didn't happen. And then Biden comes along a few years later and imposes this horrible scheme that's trying to bury a law that nobody ever repealed, that was passed unanimously by Congress with the vote of Biden, I might add, as a senator. I mean, an overwhelmingly popular law that is specifically supposed to govern the declassification of files related to the assassination. And they said, well, no, 2023, right, in June, this is the final certification under the act. Well, who says? I mean, there's no expiration. The law doesn't expire. It hasn't been repealed. And here's a president saying, here's the new scheme, right? Here's the transparency plan. And that was my first article for JFK Facts back in March of 2023, because the case was then being heard by the district court. And so I wrote a piece that explained the CIA's transparency plan and what it meant for the law and how sinister it is. And so, you know, however bad Trump was, and now he says, you know, if he's reelected, he will release them. Well, cynics will say, forget it. You know, he won't do it. And he had his chance. But I mean, a second chance, I mean, everybody deserves a second chance. What possible hope is there on the Democrat side? We don't even know if Kamala Harris has an opinion on this. I mean, she was born after the assassination. How is she going to get out in front of this issue when her boss, whose job she now wants, actually tried to bury the law? But what's happened is now a Democratic congressman is proposing, or I guess he's in the formative stages of drafting a new bill to recreate the Assassination Records Review Board, so that a new board can finish what the ARRB started and was unable to complete. I think that's great. I think the more the merrier. But I think, you know, the idea that people should just say, oh, no, we'll just go with him. Forget about Trump. Forget about Bobby Kennedy. Why? I mean, let them get out in front of each other on this. And, you know, I would, if Trump is elected and establishes an assassinations committee, and I might add, you know, I mean, he might have just been motivated to do that by the assassination attempt on himself. He might have, you know, that might be his main impetus. And frankly, if I were shot at, I'm sure I would want something like that too. But I think he will attach, you know, a function to whatever commission he sets up. I don't have a huge amount of faith in executive branch commissions, because look at the history of them. You know, Warren Commission, Rockefeller Commission, 9/11 Commission. The commissions are always suspect. They somehow never, you know, and the congressional committees are a bit better. It's like the HSC was a bit better. I mean, it came to a probable conclusion, but also had a silly sort of thing where Oswald hit and somebody missed. And, you know, I mean, that's not going to inspire confidence. But my attitude is the more initiatives that we have to get to establish plausibility and credibility and trust in that version, in that episode of our history, the better off we are. And so in addition to those two proposed initiatives, the Trump Commission and the Congressional Committee, there is also still the lawsuit in federal court to compel compliance with the JFK Act by the National Archives. So all in all, I mean, I think it's a sort of, you know, I think it's kind of an exciting time for people who still care about the JFK assassination. So I'm encouraged by that.
Well, optimistic then, maybe, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you kind of have to be. I mean, I can't live in this cynical world. Another view, of course, is that it doesn't matter what Trump says, because he's only going to be the president and he's not going to have the power to force disclosure, because presidents don't have that much power. And there is a point to be made that all presidents have basically been sort of ciphers of a sort of deep state since JFK, you know, and JFK was, I believe, removed from power because he just kept saying no to these kind of maniacs. I mean, I think that they would have gotten us into some really horrible apocalyptic war if they'd had their way. And by the time he was assassinated, it was such a shock. I think that LBJ was not a principled politician and didn't really care about the truth. Some people believe he was involved, but he just wanted to move on. And then he threw a consolation prize of the Vietnam War. You know, gee, that only cost, you know, 58,000 American lives and God knows how many Vietnamese lives. You know, it was the JFK's removal extra constitutionally really kind of put us on this new trajectory. If Trump were to get back into office and say, right, I'm going to have a commission, and then he's just undermined as well, and it never gets to the bottom of it. I mean, okay. I mean, I can accept that people have that view legitimately, but I can't, you know, I can't totally lose hope that we won't have some fundamental breakthrough that at least renders the official version.
Yeah.
You know,
what you're pointing out about JFK going against it and it cost his life, and maybe Martin King and others, you'd say now, well, somebody would have to be crazy to go up against him and say, I'm going to reveal your secrets. And I get the feeling that Trump may be like that. Like, I've got nothing left to lose. I know they tried to assassinate me. So you know what? What the hell? I'm going to release the files, you know? And
yeah.
I can't see anyone else even being that reckless, you know, or whatever you want to say for your own career and all that. But saying that, you know,
yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel the same way because, like you say, I mean, he is 78 years old. And I mean, he said about himself, you know, either love me or hate me, but you're going to have to vote for me. I've never either loved or hated him. I've always tried to sum him up because, you know, I always, you know, it's easy to kind of fall into that trap of hate and so, you know, and then you become a kind of like a reactionary, but better to just look at Trump as the phenomenon that he is, this kind of alarming looking guy who speaks in very pugilistic ways. And, you know, if he feels he's getting attacked verbally, then he doubles down and attack. I mean, we all know him.
But, you know,
now.
The poverty of the whole thing is, these are the choices. When I felt that someone running should be at least the stature like the dean of a university, where a lot of professors looked up to someone, you know,
right.
And Kamala is just, it's, I can't, the word joke doesn't come close to it. And with Trump, I always thought he was a kind of a lying shyster, like a used car salesman, gone bankrupt so many times and just real estate, you know. But then, with all the things that they threw against him, I ended up having a bit of empathy. I thought, like, what do you mean there are 200 agents in January 6th? They're dressed up as Trump supporters. They're egging the crowd on. You know, what do you mean the FBI was behind planting the pipe bombs the night before there? You know,
right.
What do you mean Russiagate's all phony? You know, I forget the name of that company from England that Clinton campaign funded and all that. You know, here's so many $100,000 if you can find a report that, you know, that the P tape and this kind of stuff. And then years later you go, well, it's all fraud. It's all fraud. So
yeah.
Even if I didn't like Trump, I have a bit of empathy, you know. Like, yeah, if you are going to release files, if you are going to have Bobby Kennedy Jr. there to maybe clean up Big Pharma and all that. I mean, that time when Biden said, we beat Big Pharma, I mean, I was laughing and pointing at the TV like that meme and say, you know, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's shameful. And of course, you know, we've seen also sort of Kamala sort of flip-flopping on things that she had long, you know, lifelong adherence to, like, you know, fracking and gun control and stuff. This is all getting sort of turned on its head.
That doesn't even matter so much as her record in California. You know, when you found out that she could have released prisoners that were found to be innocent, but they know we need them for the slave labor.
Yeah.
And the reasons, I mean, it's just, it's beyond appalling. And you think, oh, you know, they're running like the Simpsons with those, you know, space creatures. Don't blame me. I voted blue. I voted red. The same thing, you know. And it's like, okay, you know, in a perfect world, you don't like Trump. But Kamala's even worse. And you're thinking, you know, the Democratic Party, when they pulled the rug out of Bernie, it was like, oh, okay, you guys are just crooked, right? You guys are like a bike gang. And when they were pulling Bobby Kennedy Jr. like off ballots, they wouldn't even. It's when people are saying, oh, it's going to be the end of democracy. It's already the end of democracy.
Yeah.
It's such an insult that sometimes there's so many anti-Trump memes, and I post something back, you know, to say, you know, Kamala, whatever, you know, she's just totally not qualified for the job, to be polite, okay? Just not qualified at all. And then you look how long Biden was there and not qualified, and the people that kept, oh, he's the best president, he's going, it's good, oh, we're pulling the plug, right? Because,
right,
not that we don't like him, but just we can't win with him, but we would, if we could win with him, we would keep it up, you know? And then the other side of the coin where I end up having a bit of empathy for Trump is that the same thing with the documents happened to Biden. His son was getting kickbacks from Ukraine and China and stuff, 10% for the big guy. That whole laptop is Russian disinformation. And then you find out it wasn't at all.
That's right.
Are you kidding me? So I don't have to like Trump and his family, his sons and that, you know, but I go, you know what? The alternative is so anti-democratic.
Exactly. And actually, I would go so far as to say that the Democratic Party is deeply unpopular in the sense that it doesn't, it's trying to sell is an aesthetic of its own elitism to ordinary people to say, look, we're the photogenic people, or we're the whatever, you know, their whole convention with all this joy and everything. This kind of theme that they put out, it's feeling more and more fake and more detached from, from the concerns of ordinary working people. Whereas Trump, so that you've by now heard the mantra many times, social media influencers and other people saying he's a threat to democracy, you know, the threat to democracy, threat to democracy, threat to democracy. They keep repeating it over and over again. And eventually people say, well, you know, there must be something to it. He's a threat to democracy. But what they really hate, I think, and this extends, by the way, to all the sort of former Republican neoconservatives, the neocons who were staples like Dick Cheney of the neocon movement, but also, you know, Bill Kristol and John Podhoretz, the respective sons of these neocon godfathers, they despise Trump because even though they've been Republicans most of their lives, they look at Trump and they see a populist, first of all. They hate populism, but even worse than populism, they hate what they call nativism, which is kind of the tendency for people to identify with their place that they're from. Because for them, it's always what's going on over there, you know, whether it's Ukraine or it's, you know, we have to be stuck in and we have to be involved. And Trump is, you know, I mean, I personally, as an American who didn't actually grow up in America, it's hard for me to recognize him as a person. He's obviously someone from New York City, from Queens. He's kind of got that flashy, I mean, he never really took himself very seriously. I mean, he was always kind of this guy who did these kind of joke ads on SNL and stuff, or jokes, you know, he was in skits and even making fun of himself. And now he's wandered into the political arena. His first administration was sort of, you know, dysfunctional in a way because of the high turnover. But he himself, I mean, you can't deny it. There are people that really just love him. I mean, they huge crowds. I mean, he could do anything he wants practically, and they still love him. I mean, he can say whatever he wants, and it's popular. I mean, in that sense, you know. And okay, the guy is a billionaire or whatever. That's not very, you know. When's he ever had to worry about the price of groceries? But the Democrats just look more and more, you know, remote from, you know, from ordinary people. And so I think, you know, that I think give him the chance to finally clear the air, or to try to clear the air on this kind of toxic karma, this that's resonated down through the ages since the coup of 1963. And I think this transcends the left and right. I mean, you get people on the right, like Ron Paul, who's written a book, I can't remember whether it's called, but it's something like The Surreptitious Coup d'Etat or something. He wrote a book. I mean, he calls it that. I mean, it's, you know, but that neocon monolith, which now has enveloped the Democratic Party, whereas for a long time it was, you know, the rise of the neocons was George Bush Jr. That was the period from, I don't know, late 90s to, let's say, mid 2000s, when they just rose to dominance, to preeminence. They imposed their ideology of democratic globalism, or we're going to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, and we're going to bomb the hell out of places that are really far away. And that's not now in the Democrats. They're that party now. And that's what RFK Jr. says. You know, he says they're the party of war now, and that's not the party that of my uncle and father, and it certainly isn't. So yeah, I mean, I'm prepared to cut Donald Trump a break, and I mean, it might even alienate me from you know, a lot of my a lot of the sort of JFK facts community. They're just I sense that there's very, very little tolerance for any kind of Trump deference or forgiveness there, but. I just can't go with the
yeah.
With the
sort they're mad about it.
Yeah,
genuinely they, you know, it's like that. I used to the Trump derangement syndrome. I used to kind of what the hell's that, and then you run across it. You go well. Listen, it's not that I'm pro Trump so much, but I'm anti everything else. And then when he says something about the Ukraine war, you know, I want to stop the killing. I'll do everything I can to end that war right now. And of course, every arms lobbyist is going, oh, what the hell? You know, we can't have that, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now all the memes are, they're killing cats, you know?
Yeah. And I might add that, by the way, my experience of campaigning, you know, when we were out doing our thing, you know, we had a table, we had literature, and then we were doing the ballot access. You know, I mean, we dealt with a lot of passersby in a very, very blue state area. I mean, I made a couple of trips with groups out into some of the red counties in Virginia, sort of, you know, that where most people are, you know, it's a Trump supporting area or a red area. But in Alexandria, Northern Virginia and DC and suburban Maryland, the people like obvious Trump supporters would sometimes refuse to sign our petitions, you know, but they were never nasty. I mean, I don't remember a single instance of anybody being nasty. They might just say, you know, make America great again and, you know, wave friendly. But the Bidenistas, I mean, the obvious Biden supporters were so, so nasty in some cases. I mean, you know, literally melting down in front of us. I mean, hissing, red-faced, spitting, calling us despicable, and we should be ashamed. And we're just standing there looking at him. I remember this one guy starts taking our picture as if he's going to, you know, send it to somebody. Like, because we're standing there, we've got a table and we've got a Kennedy banner, and he's taking our picture. I'm like, what, you know, what are you going to give this to the FBI or something? Well, what is this? And literally just flipping out. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. These people are completely, they've gone off the deep end. So I know that the irrationality is greater on their side, by far. And so, and by the way, I just want to plug for RFK Jr.'s, I believe it's still his most recent book, but it's called The Wuhan Cover-Up and the Terrifying Bioweapons Arms Race, or I think that's what it's called, yeah. It's, you know, it's very scholarly. I mean, it's very well sourced and it's very, very logical. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, you already know that he's been very critical of Anthony Fauci. And he wrote a book about him that's scathing and was never sued for it. But the Wuhan cover-up is essentially traces the story of the a historical line of continuity between, let's say, the kind of Pentagon and CIA abuses at, you know, at Fort Detrick with the experimentation on people and the development of these kind of poisons and toxins and drugs and so forth, to a historical line of continuity between that and the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China. Because, of course, Fauci had to take his sort of gain of function research dog and pony show outside of the United States when the Obama administration halted funding. I believe it was in 2014. So he took it abroad. Well, within a few years, you know, what happens? We've got this virus, and it becomes extremely easy for everyone to become very, very afraid. Okay, and that's the key, is the fear, is to keeping people afraid of something. It's like, you know, the Cold War ends, the Soviet bloc collapses, and they're already casting around for new enemies. And now they find them in these various places, because, of course, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But now the thing that survived is this, you know, the fear of viruses and diseases. So now we have a whole complex of, which is paid for by pharma, but also designed to scare people. I mean, I've heard from some people who are much more scientific than I am that gain-of-function research is not actually that dangerous. It's just a colossal waste of money, and it's useful for scaring people. You know, it's useful for making people afraid, and once enough people are afraid, they're going to clamor for the cure. The same people who sell the fear sell the cure. And that's basically the logic of the book, the sort of underlying message of the book. But it's very detailed. And I was very convinced by it. And this is why he's called a conspiracy theorist. You know, I hate to mention Wikipedia, but, you know, if you search for anything on, you know, Google or any search engine, if Wikipedia has a page about it, Wikipedia is going to show up as the first search result, always. Okay, so if you put him in, his Wikipedia page comes up as the top hit. And in the very first sentence, it says what he is, and conspiracy theorist is in there. So he's a conspiracy theorist. That page is locked. You can't edit it. It's like the page for Lee Harvey Oswald, the page for the JFK assassination. Certain topics are just locked. So users can't edit them in the English language. But, you know, why would somebody be called? The reason he's called a conspiracy theorist is because he says there are industries that thrive on fear, and they thrive on sickness. Nothing more profitable than a sick child. Because, you know, if I can keep people sick and only give them things that kind of they only even pretend to treat symptoms. They don't treat causes. I've got an endless gravy train. You know, I've got an endless supply of income. And if that's conspiracy theory, if that's considered conspiracy theory, then read, you know, Gerald Posner's book, Pharma. I mean, if there's anybody that is the bête noire of Warren Report dissenters who's still alive, it's Gerald Posner. But he wrote a fairly serious history of the pharmaceutical industry in America and how sick it is. I mean, the whole title is Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. And it revolves mostly around the Sackler family that started the whole oxycodone opioid thing. So it doesn't deal with COVID-19 because it came out right kind of before the pandemic, but it touches on it. And it touches on the gravy train of vaccines, you know, and how these are so, so profitable. And, you know, RFK Jr. has made the point. He said, look, it was under Ronald Reagan in 1986. It was like the Vaccine Injury Act, you know, make them completely immune from liability, completely immune. So if you can get yourself considered a vaccine manufacturer, then basically anything you make is liability free. Just keep selling it, and people are definitely going to lap it up because, you know, you don't want to get that monkeypox. You know, there were some cases in sub-Saharan Africa or whatever, or there's, you know, bird flu, you know, beware because, you know, might kill you. And I just, again, the fear, sort of incentive or motivation where COVID-19 was concerned was way, way overblown, in my opinion. And people are going to argue this point, but I think Bobby Kennedy has been pretty consistent about it. It was actually did not merit what they did. And Trump actually bears responsibility to a large extent for his warp speed rollout. Because then what happened was the Biden administration succeeded him. They had they tried to push mandates and lockdowns. And, you know, I remember going to his protest, his demonstration, defeat the mandates in early 2022, you know, and they had like SWAT teams, police helicopters circling over the loud, you know, ridiculous. You know, it's like, oh, dangerous. These guys, you know, instead of propagating dangerous views, and it's going to, you know, affect people because they'll be afraid to get the vaccine. Well, what if you don't need the vaccine? You know, what if you're a healthy sort of person who does not suffer from any chronic illnesses and you say, well, I don't want it? Then, you know, and that's what I did. And I'm not saying I wasn't afraid like everybody else in 2020. I was. But by the end of that year, before the vaccines had even come out, just by looking at the online statistics, even from non-conspiratorial sources like CDC and other websites that were tracking the demographics of serious illness and fatality, it was, you know, it was not that serious. I mean, this was not something that was going to wipe everybody out. What did wipe people out was like the New York nursing home scandal where they, you know, Andrew Cuomo sort of herded these elderly, vulnerable people into sort of confined areas and like 15,000 of them died. I mean, that is mismanagement. That is reacting in a panic way. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how things are up in Canada. I'm sure they can't be this bad. I know that Justin Trudeau definitely cracked down. He sort of, you know, invoked the Emergencies Act. And I've listened to that very good attorney that you have on sometimes, Ray McGinnis, on your show. And I learn a lot from him and what's going on in Canada, because I think it's very important. It's a big neighbor. It matters what happens next door. And he, you know, Trudeau cracked down. He seized people's bank accounts. We didn't go quite that far here. But I think they would have done it if they could have. And I think that they looked at, for example, Saudi Arabia, which enacted a universal vaccine mandate in 2021. Okay. Everybody in the kingdom, whether they were, you know, a native or a visitor, anyone wanting to visit and anyone wanting to leave had to, you know, have an app with a QR code where that could be scanned and showed all your health data, your vaccination status, and your movements would be tracked. And they just imposed it on everybody for a year, and you better comply or else, because this is not a democracy and we don't pretend to be. And then they just lifted it just as quickly a year later. And I'm looking around at all these democratically elected leaders and thinking, boy, I bet you they are envious. I bet you they're looking at MBS, who was, you know, not long ago accused of murder. And in fact, the Canadian government was one of the most outspoken against them. And they're thinking, if only we could do that. You know, I mean, like, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I mean, this is considered conspiracy theory. I'm sorry. But, it's, you know, it, to me, it's common sense. It's just common sense. So, So yeah, so that's, I mean, that I guess is at the, you know, that's really at the bottom of my motivation for supporting RFK Jr. And I'm reassured that some really great minds like David Talbot and Dick Russell have been part of the campaign, you know, since the beginning. Unfortunately, David Talbot had that horrible stroke because he was writing these great articles for the Kennedy Beacon. But yeah, I mean, we'll stay. And if Bobby Kennedy can get like a health and human services secretary position, like that kind of cabinet position in a Trump administration, I think it could transform, you know, our society, because it's a very powerful position if it's used to its full potential. It can really, really reform and transform all these agencies, like, you know, FDA, NIH, CDC. They're all subordinate to the HHS secretary. So you don't need to create like a health czar. There is a health czar. It's just it's not really used properly. And he knows how the system works. I mean, he's, as he said, if you litigate enough, you become very educated in whatever field you're in. You become like an expert because, you know, you have to find out everything about the case, about the defendants and the prosecution and the plaintiffs and what have you.
Well, I loved his line when he said, when I was battling to clean up the river, he said, "Look, when I was trying to get lead out of the fish, nobody said I was anti-water, you know, or lead out of the water, you know. I mean, it's just like I'm trying to clean up stuff,
Yeah.
you know."
Yeah. I mean, exactly. And I mean, I think he, you know, he qualifies as a real environmentalist. I've always thought that the whole climate, you know, the whole climate change thing was it always felt to me too much like one of those orthodoxies, you know, one of those things that it develops into an orthodoxy that no one can question. And then you're in the realm of the kind of the unspeakable, to use the old James Douglas book title taken from you know, an idea from a Trappist monk, Thomas Merton. You know, he explains it. It's similar to the kind of censorship that goes on around things like that. The climate crisis and what we have to do to reduce to zero, you know, the carbon emissions of everything, and it becomes this kind of kind of justifying or a kind of movement or orthodoxy, and then it becomes fossilized. There's that, and then there's the sort of anti-vaxxer stigma. And you know, if you dare to criticize any vaccine, you become a kook. You become a freak and a nut. And he has really not wavered. I mean, he says, look, you know, if you want to get vaccinated, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to stand in your way, but you can't have zero liability for all vaccine manufacturers and then expect that there won't in the end be some kind of consequence for this, that there won't be. I mean, I'm sorry, but it just makes sense. I mean, there used to be before that vaccine, I think it's called the Vaccine Injury Act in the 1980s, these vaccines were rolled out for different things and they were withdrawn all the time. And they were withdrawn for very small numbers of recorded or reported injuries, like the swine flu vaccine in the 70s, which I think Gerald Ford and his wife, you know, they did the photo op of getting it in the White House. To show everybody how important it was. And then they had a very small number of what's called Guillain, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the French right, Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS. And a tiny number were recorded and they withdrew the whole thing, withdrew the whole swine flu vaccine. Well, they've had many, many more reports of that with the COVID-19 vaccines. And there's been
And they're just coming out. And that's one thing that they were underreported. There was an uphill battle to even enter in the reports of adverse reactions. And name another industry where if your product harms somebody, you can't sue them.
Exactly. It's like a faith. It's like a kind of religious conviction. It's like the infallibility of vaccine manufacturers. How ridiculous! I mean, they're made for profit. And one of the economic consequences, another thing Bobby Kennedy brings up a lot, which both parties are guilty of, is this national debt situation. So let's say that the U.S. national debt is $35 trillion, okay? And the largest annual payment of the federal government now is the interest payment on that debt. So that's the single largest expenditure that goes out of the federal budget. I mean, if you have a massive vaccine rollout like we had for Operation Warp Speed and all over the world, what's basically happening is that governments, national governments, are saying, yes, please send this many doses of vaccine. And yes, here's the money we pay for it. That money, apart from the fact that it's adding to the debt, it's being passed down to, future generations, right? I mean, this is not something that's ever going to get paid back. These companies don't care. They don't care whether, the future is threatened by their ridiculous, ineffective vaccines that don't prevent infection or transmission. So what? Go down to the drugstore. It's free, right? It's free. And get your jab and you'll feel so much better. And unfortunately, I think that the vaccines were sort of popular because people were very concerned about themselves and their families. And they thought, well, I'd better do that because after all, it's being offered for free down the street. I'll just go and get my jabs and stay up to date.
Yeah. One thing I regret hearing about it and just regret was it says, well, listen, you could be asymptomatic, that you could have it and not even know it, but then take it home to your, elderly parents or something,
Yeah.
And it was like, when you look back at it, you go, what are you talking about? You have it and you don't even know it,
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the point. I mean, okay, there's this argument that it ameliorates the symptoms. Okay, well, I don't know that that's actually been proven, but the point is the governments of the world, especially Western governments, they did panic about their health systems getting overwhelmed, like people rushing in massive numbers to hospitals that could only accommodate a fraction of that number. And so if you give people, it's a bit like giving them the Warren Report. The Warren Report is like a tranquilizer. It's like a pill or a palliative because everyone's worried that something really awful happened. But here we've got the explanation. Take that. I can breathe more easily. And the vaccines would had the effect of preventing people from rushing to the hospital at the first sign of the sniffles after COVID had been declared as a pandemic, because they might get the sniffles or a slight sore throat. And instead of worrying, say, well, I've had the jab. I guess I don't need to go down there. And it did have that effect. But, I mean, it's so corrupt. I mean, in principle, it's just a corrupt foundation. So, I don't know what the vaccines have done in terms of, of injuring people. And I don't think it's really that important. I mean, of course, I don't want, there to be a massive people dropping dead from vaccines. But the point is, it's very corrupt. And if you decided that you were going to take your chances with your natural immune system in confronting COVID, as I did, and I got COVID, it wasn't, pleasant, but it wasn't the worst thing that I ever had, and I got it once, then you were sort of, if you decided not to, then you were sort of, that was the only way that you could make a stand on principle and say, yeah, I don't know whether these vaccines are really dangerous or not. and I don't care. I don't want to, I just don't want to join in, and I want to keep the core, even if we're a minority. I want to be part of that core that said, you know, stop this insanity. Stop sweeping people up in this and threatening their livelihoods and saying, if you work in this sector of the economy, you have to be jabbed or you lose your job. You know, there were people that were, you know, that were genuinely fearful, and they were employers, and they were looking out, and they believed the whole, they believed the whole hype. They sort of, you know, drank the Kool-Aid, I think. I just don't think, you know, and people will argue this forever, and they say, oh, it was a terrible, it killed a million Americans and all the rest of it. And I just, it never really, it was never really backed up that well. And RFK Jr.'s advocacy group, Children's Self-Defense, which has been online for a long time, but of course it's not exactly making headlines. It's not going to be their scholarly reports and all this analysis that they do from these reputed doctors, you know, well-reputed. They're not going to, you know, that's not going to be front and center. And if anybody notices, it's going to, oh, it's going to be an anti-vaxxer conspiracy theory. But, you know, it's all there. It's basically all explained in terms of there's no need to be for everyone to be so afraid. This is part of this biosecurity state or biosecurity agenda, which is like the post-Cold War surrogate for an enemy. You know, for defining enemies as being, you know, whatever that next virus is that's coming out, everybody needs to mask up and get the next shot. So, so I really am hoping that RFK Jr. can make a difference, and I think he's already achieved a lot in terms of kind of, in terms of just because he's been so busy on the podcast circuit. I mean, he's talked to pretty much anybody who would talk to him, who has any kind of a sizable audience. I mean, he's really gotten around. And after a while, MSM just becomes in itself sort of marginalized. It comes marginalized for people who want to...
Well, totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, irrelevant. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's, and that's why it's sort of failing. And it deserves to fail. I mean, we had the Trump... Harris debate on ABC, and I was thinking to myself as I watched this, and it was not a pleasant experience. This is the most viewership that ABC has since, you know, they used to host Monday Night Football like almost 20 years ago. I mean, I can't imagine a single thing that people would watch ABC for. I mean, it's not just ABC, all of those networks. I mean, they're so boring. All of them, and Fox as well. I'm sorry, they're not, they're no, I mean, just because they are supposed to be the conservative, whatever network, it's terrible. Everybody's getting their news from other sources, from podcasts, from,
yeah, you know, Tucker Carlson, he's got his own show, Joe Rogan, right?
Exactly,
even Jimmy Dore, other people, Russell Brand,
yeah,
and the list goes on, you know, just to it where people are tuning in to saying, I want, you know, whether I agree with the guy or not. At least somebody will believe them. Like some of friends, they don't like Russell Brand because he laughs or he's a bit of a comedian. At the same time, maybe it's the same with Jimmy Dore, but at least you can count on the guy's giving you an honest opinion. And it's not, you know, parroted down by the head office that, you know, we're backing this guy. So everything, you know, it's just like with Kamala, nobody who voted for her. I mean, you know, I don't have to get into that, but whatever.
She's never won a single delegate. She never had to compete in any. Well, I mean, she did compete in primaries in 2020, and it was
embarrassing.
Really pitiful. Yeah, really embarrassing. I mean, she's just not a popular figure.
Yeah, like,
but yeah,
Tulsi Gabbard would have been a better candidate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and she humiliated Kamala, and people remember that. And now Tulsi Gabbard is also backed Trump. I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, I can't call this, but I certainly don't blame Bobby Kennedy for what he's done. I think he's a sensible man. And unfortunately, because we're so image conscious in America and everything has to be sort of, you know, kind of that anodyne PR image maker type of that sort of normative influence where everybody looks sort of mannequin like. I mean, with his voice, this vocal cord problem, I mean, the average American is just going to say, well, there's something wrong with him. So, you know, and that's sad, but it's true.
Well,
and,
it was an adverse reaction to a vaccine.
That's right. He says that. He says this was very likely a vaccine injury. And who can disprove it? You know, and I just really appreciate what he's done. And I hope he can really affect meaningful change in the system. But it's going to require Trump to be reelected. And, you know, Trump hopefully learned some serious lessons from his first term. I mean, he had very high turnover in his administration. I mean, think about it. He had Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Secretary of Defense as well, Mattis. These people all left in like one or less than 2 years, and they were replaced. And I don't know what the turnover was high in other positions too, like Chief of Staff and National Security Advisor and all this other stuff. I mean, it was classic. It was his reality show, right? The Apprentice, you're fired. I mean, after a while it became, but I mean, I don't really care that much about that. To me, that
the funny thing is, I remember hearing him talk about, he goes, well, these guys are crazy.
Yeah.
They left all that millions and billions of military gear there. They just said, we're going to leave it there. I says, well, you guys are crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he is, you know, of the opinion that the country's gone nuts, and it sort of has. I'm sorry, but it feels like we've taken leave of our senses collectively. And I would just really like to see people wake up from this and say, you know, we can do better than this. We don't have to constantly respond to fear mongering, you know? And I mean, I know that Black Op Radio covers a lot of issues, and I really appreciate it. It's not just the JFK assassination, but I write about the JFK assassination, you know, for JFK Facts, and I still study it a lot. I go to the archives. It's like 25 miles down the road, a couple of times a week at least. But I mean, you know, you cover these other issues, which are just as important, I guess. But the culture of the assassination, the legacy of it is fear. Because if we accept that what happened on November 22nd, 1963 was a de facto coup d'etat, even if the conditions for the sidelining of the president as a real power already existed by the time JFK became president. And, you know, Harry Truman and Eisenhower they didn't see it on the rise. They didn't feel it. Eisenhower warned, by the time he warned, it was too late. And JFK was, you know, he was swept aside. But, you know, I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to live at that time and how fearful people must have been. How afraid, because so many people were threatened for daring to come forward or killed. And that there's a karma. See, I'm kind of sounding like a mystic now, but, you know, karma carries down through the ages and it stays with a society. And that society become, you know, is the legatee of this kind of sheepish, fearful demeanor and attitude that, you know, that they have with them as they go about their lives. And the latest thing that they come is like, you know, my God, Putin, you know, he's going to take over the world. He's going to take over Europe. Well, he's not going to do that. And I mean, if you go to Russia.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Bobby Kennedy is very good at describing the origins of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember I spent a lot of time in Ukraine, a lot. A long time ago, I actually lived there for a year. It was like 2002. So, and I was doing kind of human rights, democracy monitoring, election monitoring back then in the former sort of socialist bloc, I guess you would call it. So ex-Soviet Union plus Yugoslavia and Albania. And I decided I would base myself in Kiev. Well, I know that country really well. And I mean, it's sad to have to say it because, you know, now you sound like, you know, Putin, like great Russian chauvinist when he said to George W. Bush at a kind of NATO summit, I think in 2008, he said, you know, it's not a real country, or, you know, it's not even a country, or something like that. Well, the average American isn't going to understand what that means because we live in this world of nation states where you have an embassy of a country in your country, and that means you recognize it as a country. It's a sovereign nation state, and it has the right to establish consulates and all the rest of it. And, you know, Putin, it should be hard for him to explain why he decided to engage on a full-scale invasion when he also has a Ukrainian embassy and consulates on the territory of Russia proper. So, well, you recognize him, and then you went ahead and decided to denazify. But, you know, we did provoke it. I mean, and this is the neocon thing. It's like, oh, that whole thing about how we provoked it, you know, that's just, you know, they'll say you're just a Putin fanboy or whatever. But, you know, if someone is a, you know, has a tendency to, I guess, react in a certain way that maybe is violent and you know it, and you go and poke them in the chest and then they react, yeah, you still provoked them. And unfortunately, the great tragedy of Ukraine is that, and even the New York Times reported this, they reported that the CIA had set up a bunch of bases in Ukraine near the Russian border. Now, if you're Putin and you find that out, your justification for going in and making sure those bases don't stay there is not going to be that. It's going to be some other thing you make up. Why? Because he's a spy too, and he's never going to let everybody else know what he knows. So he's going to say, yeah, we need to denazify it. And what he's really saying is, I don't like this I don't like this eastward extension of your deep state right on my border. And yes, we definitely provoked him. And the war is a huge tragedy. And there are people who are living in eastern Ukraine. They have absolutely zero identity, self-identity as Ukrainian. It doesn't mean... I mean, actually, in Canada, I think you have quite a lot of Ukrainians, but you know, the difference between the west of Ukraine, you know, those areas bordering kind of Poland and Hungary and so forth, and those areas down in the Donbas, is so huge that the people in the west probably wouldn't care if they broke away. They don't care, but they can't say that now, because if you say that, it's treason.
Well, the eastern did want to separate after 2014, and...
Absolutely.
And, you know,
yeah.
We don't have to get into the whole thing there, but I mean, Western Ukraine started attacking them, bombing them for eight years.
Yeah.
You know?
And actually, the overthrow that happened in Kiev in February 2014, which preceded the escalation of violence in the east by several weeks. You know, once that happened, that regime which took over from the ousted president, they never actually secured enough votes in their own parliament to legitimize his ouster. They held a vote almost immediately. And under the Constitution, they were supposed to have a minimum number of votes to legitimize it. And they fell short, and they never accounted for that. And it was just a typical, you know, Victoria Nuland State Department, oh, don't worry about that. That's a minor thing. Forget about it. But of course, who's watching all this time? You know, Moscow. Moscow is saying, well, you know, this is completely illegal. It's violent. There's been people killed in the street, and it's militant, you know. And so, of course, you know, they reacted almost immediately. So, yeah, we are the architects of the tragedy there. I have no doubt about it. And, and Bobby Kennedy is right. I mean, I don't know how we now bring it to an end, but it has to be brought to an end. And so Trump is saying, I'm going to end it. Well, let him exercise the art of the deal. Let's see what happens and give him a shot, because it's not going to happen under the Democrats, I don't think. Yeah.
Okay, well, your article is up at Kennedy's and King right now, the one that we were talking, RFK Jr. and the Unspeakable, Why This Historic Moment Matters. And I'll make a link to that and urge people to read it.
And well, then, thank you.
Well, yeah, of course. And then you mentioned your other Substack, and you want to mention again where people can find your work?
Yeah, I mean, I can also send you a link to some of the work I've done for JFK Facts. One thing in particular I'll just mention is a 12-part series that I did from early March, and it went, I guess, until late May, and it was weekly, and it was called Trail of Destruction. And I covered 12 different episodes of the destruction of official records related to the assassination of President Kennedy by the agencies that controlled them, the different federal agencies. So we're looking at, like, I think, seven different federal agencies. I mean, the largest share of incidents were the CIA, but there was also, you know, FBI and Army intelligence and so forth. So from
Secret Service, I think, too.
Secret Service, yeah, they're the last one. So the timeline runs from 1963, in fact, November 23rd, which was the date of the LBJ Hoover phone call where they talk about someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City. We have only the transcript, but not the phone call. That was erased. And you can actually hear it on an LBJ library tape. You could just hear the magnetic belt with a little, like every few seconds, you can hear what sounds like LBJ grunting monosyllabically. And that's the sound of history being erased. And then the 1995, it goes runs all the way through to the 1995 destruction by the Secret Service of their protective survey reports for JFK's trips from September, October, and up through early November. So that covers the Chicago sort of plot. And I'll send you a link to that series and some things that I've written about the federal court case litigation and one or two, I guess, other things. And I still would like to use that series as the sort of framework or skeleton for a book-length work, because every episode, these articles are quite long, every episode tells a different story. What do you infer from the destruction? We saw, you know, Anthony Fauci's assistant during those COVID hearings being questioned by a congressman who said, under our law, we are entitled to make an adverse inference from the fact of the destruction of evidence. In this case, it was emails, right, about COVID and the origins of the pandemic, the origins of the virus. So that's a point of law. And there are so many inferences we can make from the destruction of records. And that is one of the causes of action in the case of Mary Farrell Foundation v. Biden and the National Archives. So if your listeners want to read about those things, I'll send you a link to that. And just thank you for continuing to do to interview so many different kinds of people. I mean, I listen to Black Op Radio every week because I drive. It's great to listen to driving to and from the archives. So, you know, even if it's like a 2-hour episode, it takes me an hour to get there and an hour to get back. It's great driving material. And really, really have enjoyed some of these guests you've had. And I thought that the last John Armstrong interview of August 15th, where he talked about the Dallas police transcripts, I thought that was really fascinating. And he's more responsible than anybody else for convincing me that there's no way that our guy shot by Jack Ruby could have shot the policeman, J.D. Tippit. So,
yeah. Well, it's very interesting. And there's a few people that just say, oh, he's crazy, don't believe anything. But I urge people just to read into it, because let's say you agree with only half of it. There's a 50% of information that you didn't get anywhere else but John's work.
Right.
And digging up the transcripts and then seeing how they differ from the actual audio and what they've edited out.
The granular, I mean, it's really granular in detail, and it's very moment by moment. So when he describes, for example, in the last interview, the jacket, the sort of dark gray blue jacket that was placed over J.D. Tippit's body when he was shot, he was on the ground, and what the shooter was said to be wearing and what Oswald was wearing when he left his rooming house and then when he was arrested in the theater. You know, it's very, and the wallet as well. It's very, very.
And then where they find the jacket in the lunchroom.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
But at and, least and those, you have
those
that.
Two guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Westbrook and Croy, those two cops, they went back to the depository. Well, do you think they had the jacket with them when they did? I suspect so. So yeah, he's very, very interesting. I always think he's worth a listen, and he's on the side of as I think one of the episodes in 50 Reasons for 50 Years, he says that he believes the entire Oswald in Mexico City thing is a hoax. And then there are those people who say, oh, no, no, he was definitely there. And he definitely visited the, you know, the Soviet embassy and the Mexican and the Cuban consulate. And I'm in the sort of Bill Simpich category. Bill Simpich has a couple of ebooks on the Mary Farrell website. One's called State Secret and one's called The 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend. And they are so detailed, especially on Mexico City. It's astounding. I mean, it really is extraordinary. It's almost an information overload. And he describes himself as an agnostic on Oswald in Mexico City. And I suppose I fall into that category as well. I mean, I just...
Well, you could take the other side of the coin and say, prove to me he was there. Talk me into it that he was there. I know you have this Warren Commission and anecdotal evidence, but am I doubting it? You know, the Greyhound signatures of people and the two women, so they witnessed him coming back. And it just, the whole thing becomes fraud after fraud. So yeah. I'm a doubting Thomas. But, you know, that's only one small item. You can either subscribe to that or not, or still have an interest in it. But yeah. The thing, I take a little criticism for having John Armstrong on and that, but then it's like, Of a few of the things that I don't have to go into, the things that I disagree with or don't subscribe to. But then later on, some of these things come up. You know, you go, wait a minute, John was talking about that 10 years ago. Now, yeah. How does this fit into there? I mean, you know, there's that, the flight out of
Vincent.
Dallas. Vincent, yeah, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Now, if you subscribe to that and the guy says that was a spitting image. I mean, that was the guy. He flew out in a military plane.
Yeah.
Imposter. You see, with John, he's much more dedicated to the premise of the two people, Harvey and Lee. But if you even just go to, well, look at, we know there was imposters. So maybe there was even three or four.
Right. Exactly.
So
yeah.
So you don't have to be stuck to that. And the thing I like about John is he usually starts off his interviews, look, if I'm wrong, please point it out because I don't want to be wrong. But here's my opinion on this. And people can write and say, oh, he's crazy. But I say, okay, well, show me where he's wrong.
Right.
And then,
right.
you know, bring it up with John. I don't need to get in the middle. But I just like having people on have done good work.
Right.
Good research.
And I will just, one last thing about the imposter issue. I mean, having thought so much about why there's no photo or audio recording of Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City, when the CIA had this massive surveillance operation, it was like the biggest in the world, I think. You know, the station in Mexico City was gigantic and not a single photograph. Well, one of the stories that JFK facts broke last year was the story of one of the Mexican CIA agents who was employed for photographic surveillance in one of the base houses targeting the entrance to the Soviet embassy. Now, she died in the 2000s. I think it was 2008. But her son was also a CIA agent. He had a cryptonym because they employed families. They employed, you know, husband, wife, and a couple of sons because, you know, it was for security, for one thing. I mean, if they talked to anybody, they'd probably just talk to each other. And this guy said, you know, until she died, she swore she got a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald coming and going at the Soviet embassy. And, you know, she sworn to secrecy and everything, and she died. Now, Rex Bradford, the president of the Mary Farrell Foundation, his foundation published the Lopez Report, an edition, I don't remember what year it was, but he says in the introduction, what are the possibilities? Okay, one possibility is that Oswald did show up, but there was somebody else in the photo that the CIA did not want anyone to see. The second possibility is it was somebody who really, really looked like Oswald. I mean, an uncanny resemblance. But if you looked closely enough, if you really studied it, you would see, you would notice that the differences and say, wait a minute, that's not the guy. I mean, his hair's squared off at the back or whatever it is. And then there's a third possibility that this was all really just part of the, you know, the Peter Dale Scott thing where they establish one narrative and then force everybody to cover up and then shift to a different narrative, sort of the CIA planning the whole thing in advance. Any one of those could be true. But I lean heavily towards somebody who really looked like him, and that this woman who never saw the prints, she only gave her film to the guy who picked it up and took it away and never saw it again. So she's going by memory, and her son said she had a photographic memory of looking through her camera and taking pictures. And this guy said, my mother never forgot anything. And somebody showed up at the Soviet embassy one day, and then they didn't show up again for 6 weeks. She would remember. So she was sure that she, and maybe she saw a doppelganger. You know, it really boggles the mind. And I certainly think it was some kind of doppelganger who shot J.D. Tippit. You know, I can't get that out of my head. So I like.
Well, you know, the description was a short, fat man.
Yeah. Well, there's that as well. And there's also at least one witness who said there was more than one person fleeing from the scene.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway. Well, it's been good to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you for your good work. And people can pick up where you send me links where you want me to add to the show notes. And also at Kennedy's and King, we'll make a link to that right away.
You bet. Okay, Len. Well, thanks so much. And I hope everything's great out there in British Columbia, a place I've always wanted to visit and I'm sure we'll do one day.
All right. Well, let me know for sure ahead of time.
Thank you. Yeah, you bet.
All right. Speaking to Chad Nagel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Len. Bye-bye. Okay.